Welcome to our Corcoran monthly discussion. My name is Rachel Pachta, and I'm the Director of Ministry for the Missioners of Christ. I'm joined today by my wonderful co-hosts, Angela Whitehouse and Kate Harmeyer, as we have our final episode on The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. We chat today about our favorite characters and great connection that Kate makes as to who the bus driver is at the end of the episode. So without further ado, here is our third and final discussion on The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis.
Tragedian.
That's what I meant.
There it is.
So now we know.
So now we know. How to say tragedian on YouTube. It's an actual video, and it will repeat tragedian for 1 minute.
Well, that's what we really need. That's if nothing else, we've accomplished that tonight.
Now we know how to pronounce it. How are you all? Happy October, the month of glory.
It is in our neck of the woods. It is the month of glory. I love October. It's my favorite.
Yeah.
My husband said to me, this October feels like the March of fall because we're so like our schedule is so insane that it's not. Yeah. It's been hard to find slices of time to kind of just enjoy it. But when I have, it is the greatest month. The weather is so lovely and the trees are just so lovely. And so many great saints feast during October. Mm-hmm. That's been really nice too.
Mm-hmm. It's like a nonstop lineup. Culminating in the beautiful All Saints Day, which is very exciting. So
I thought you were going to say culminating in your birthday, Angela, October 28th. You didn't have to do that, but
it is culminating. It is the month of Angela's birth.
It's the pinnacle.
It is the month of
October 28th. Stop,
Angela. Yeah. Tell us what you like, Angela, so maybe you can get some things in the mail. What are some things you like? Do you know the CFRs do this on their podcast? They do this intentionally because they're beggars, so they'll mention like, "Oh man, I really like this brand of cookies."
I'm legit not a beggar, so I would just feel really guilty.
Well, okay, let's list some things that you like, and then maybe people can spoof on.
Like,
that.
What are things I like?
I'm pretty sure for your birthday the last couple of years, I've just gotten you Starbucks gift cards.
Which is awesome. I love coffee. Coffee's always good.
She likes coffee, so everyone sent her.
Like coffee. I like brownies. I like dessert. I like anything that's yummy. Anything like that.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
And I like you.
Oh,
thank you. We appreciate you. So happy birthday month, Angela. I hope it lasts. I hope it's an amazing, amazing month of joy and goodness.
Gosh, guys, I really didn't expect all this. So, I mean, I did. I totally did. But thank you. Thank you.
What a month. What a month it is.
Okay. So I want to talk about These are the best characters in the whole book. Let me just throw it out there. Like, objectively, these final characters and the encounters are the deepest and most, in some cases, hopeful. And for me personally, when I've read it, given me the most to really think and pray about. So, mm-hmm.
Yes, it's like as all of it kind of builds to these last few chapters and especially these last few characters. And they're the ones that you keep remembering and kind of bringing up in conversation after you've read this book, mm-hmm. I think. And always the ones that you lead with when you're kind of convincing someone to tough out those first few, those first few chapters where you don't quite know what's going on and you're like, but it gets so good. Yeah. This is what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. All right. I love a good contrast of characters. My favorite two chapters in the whole book are chapters 11 and 12. The really, really long one is really chapter 11. And there's a great contrast of characters in this chapter. Mm-hmm. Character number one is the mother. Character number two is the man with the lizard. And they kind of stand at these poles. One is a really hopeful. But the first one that we have is like when the desires of our heart are not redeemed.
Are you talking about the mother?
The mother.
Mm-hmm.
The mother. I hurt listening to this a little bit because I'm a mother and I understand that kind of like visceral love feeling, that attachment to a child. I get that. I get where she's coming from. Like, having, she clearly, this mother has like lost a child, but what happened was like her life just kind of stopped. And it was clearly like, this looked like it was her favorite child and she had been smothering him. What did you guys think about her?
So one thing that I took away on page 99, it says that it's her brother, right? Who's speaking mm-hmm. to her. He's the ghost. Wait, it's not the ghost, the spirit that's speaking to her. He says, you're treating God only as a means to Michael, but the whole thickening treatment consists in learning to want God for his own sake. And then he goes on, you exist as Michael's mother only because you first exist as God's creature. And I think what I took from her story, I mean, there's so many things there to pull from, but just that, like you were saying, Rachel, an unredeemed love, even for a son or even for a daughter, because it's not your first love, because it's not God's love and, you know, desiring his love above all else, it can become thwarted. It can become, you know, in her example, it became, she was holding on to Michael instead of holding on to the Lord. And it became the thing that kept her from the Lord. Mm-hmm. I think it was interesting. It was like something that's so good, a love for her son who she had lost, had become perverted because she hadn't allowed that love to be redeemed. She hadn't allowed that love to be transformed. It's just, there's a lot there. Like, there's just a lot to think about.
And I think back a little to the nagging wife, in the sense of, it is a related situation where one's vocation became something that became an idol or became perverted. And so here we see it in something that does gut punch a little bit more, because we feel more pity for this character because she is a grieving mother. And because it does feel that although her love was not submitted to the Lord, it was in some ways a self-emptying love. And so you feel a little bit more for her, and therefore the kind of pulling out of the disorder and bringing it into the light as like you watch it unfold is just a little bit more, I feel, piercing and relatable and less cringy, if that makes sense. You know, it's I was looking at that same section that you were talking about there, where it goes on later on that same page where it says that human beings can't make one another really happy for long.
Yeah. We see her kind of go downhill, and it was her brother, and the way that he speaks, you kind of hear about it. I'm on page 100 where it says, he wanted you to love Michael as he as in God understands love. You cannot love a fellow creature fully till you love God. Sometimes this conversion can be done while the instinctive love is still gratified, but there was, it seems, no chance of that in your case. The instinct was uncontrolled and fierce and monomaniac. Ask your daughter or your husband, ask your own mother. You haven't once thought of her. You know, it was the perversion of that love. And he kind of starts to bring out, but yes, you had these loving feelings. But then George MacDonald, even later to C.S. Lewis, when he was like, how, you know, when they're contrasting, like, how can one turn out to be so glimmering and virtuous, when we talk about the man in a minute, and then how can the other, who was like a grieving mother who just really, really loved her son, and he said, oh no, she didn't love him. That was a perversion of love. But don't you dare call that love, because love can only happen in God. Authentic love can only happen in God. And she was unwilling to love God first. And I love later down on page 100, he says, Pam, she says, this is all nonsense, cruel and wicked nonsense. What right have you to say things like that about mother love? It is the highest and holiest feeling. See that? Highest and holiest feeling in human nature. She's still stuck on the feeling. She's Pam, no natural feelings are high or low, holy or unholy in themselves. This is very Catholic. Mm-hmm. This is a very Catholic notion and understanding of the passions. Mm-hmm. They're amoral, anger, happiness, satisfaction, these feelings of love, right? Even of mother love. They are not high or low, holy or unholy in themselves. They are all holy when God's hand is on the rein. They all go bad when they set up on their own and make themselves into false gods. Mm-hmm. And I think we've probably all had an experience at one time or another of maybe something being precariously or maybe even going over the line of becoming a false god because of how much we care about something. Something is a very important thing to us and a very big deal to us. And maybe it's a friendship. Maybe it is a relationship with a child. Maybe it's somewhere within the family, a relationship that becomes so important that it becomes the thing itself and it becomes God. And like you were saying, Kate, the idea of, and this goes back to the idea that we had last time of like that thing, we always have to keep ourselves in check that our vocation and even the joy and love that comes along with that does not become the actual idol and take the place of God and God as only a means to deepening that relationship or only a means to even becoming like a better mother, but that all is submitted to God himself and to his service and his dominion.
I think this one is hard because it just seems like there's such a fine balance. Mm-hmm. Like we're walking a very fine line of like the love that she has for her son and this grief that she's experienced. And it's almost scandalous to say like she didn't love. I don't know. It's almost like this side of heaven. It's very rare that we would go up to a grieving mother. And I think he mentions that.
He does. I'm going to go to that while you're saying this. Go ahead. Keep going.
Because it's like this side of heaven, it would be like, you go to a grieving mother and you're like, well, did you love him? I know you kind of loved him, but is that really love? Because yeah. And you start, it feels like there's this very, I don't know how to articulate it, but it's like a very fine line between she had loved her son and then how she ended up living her life after this point was just not in fulfillment of what God was asking of her and what true eternal love looked like.
Yeah. And well, you're like, literally you are the C.S. Lewis right now. Like you're really articulating this part in the book. I'm on page 105 where he says, but could one dare, could one have the face to go to a bereaved mother in her misery when one's not bereaved oneself? And George MacDonald says, no, son, that's no office of yours. You're not a good enough man for that.
Yeah. He's like, no, don't do that. Don't do that.
Own heart,
bad idea.
Yeah. When your own heart's been broken, it will be time for you to think of talking. Mm. But someone must say in general, what's been unsaid among you this many a year, that love, as mortals understand the word, isn't enough. Every natural love will rise again and live forever in this country, but none will rise again until it has been buried.
And then right after, the C.S. Lewis character says, that saying is almost too hard for us. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what Angela's saying. And that's why this chapter really does like pull back a layer of skin almost and really get in at it, because it is, as we've seen in a lot of these characters, but no more clearly than in this one, we see people like stopping at the creature and not getting to the creator, or in the sense of the artist, stopping at the paint and forgetting the light. And in this instance, stopping at the sun and failing to see him as God's son first and you as God's child, and submitting all of those things to his providence and authority. And it, in particular, like it's very gut-wrenching when you see that she does have some really raw and real pain inside of her, like even now, even years later, of the loss. On 103 at the top, I just wrote ouch next to the top section there, where she says, and she gets, you know, has some very strong words of, I don't believe in a God who keeps mother and son apart. I believe in a God of love. No one has a right to come between me and my son, not even God, and tell him that to his face. I mean, it's, you know, we're on the line here of some blasphemy, but it's coming from a really raw place of pain. But that pain, like also that pain wasn't allowed to be redeemed and transformed. Because in the conversation there, between her brother and the mother, they talked about it being a case for surgery, you know, that the relationship could not have been redeemed on earth even, you know, and so the separation of death, maybe prematurely, was even for the purpose, or could have been an opportunity for both of them to grow in holiness and to grow closer to the Lord. Mm. Which again, that is almost too hard for us. That saying is too hard for us, you know?
Yeah. And that's by no means to say like everyone who's lost a child it's because of this, you know.
No.
It's just this situation that he's talking about. But yeah, this is.
Yeah, and it goes to show that the higher, you know, he uses the George MacDonald, I think, when he's unpacking this, as C.S. Lewis is kind of going through all of these emotions and observations that we're having now, as he's unpacking it, he talks about how, you know, the higher the good, like the worse it can become, you know, that like the higher the angel, the worse the demon, like, you know, and so that it's the stronger the angel, and therefore when it falls, a fiercer devil, that the more beautiful things in life, like mother love, are easier to be mistaken for the real thing. Mm-hmm. So it says something like, you know, like copper is more likely, or no, brass is mistaken more for gold than clay is.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this also goes into when we're about to go, we're like one paragraph away where we are right now of meeting the next man who's going to contrast this mother. Because we see this mother love, which is a beautiful love when redeemed, right? And we're going to see later that what's going to happen is she's going to, you know, George MacDonald's like, she very well right now could be demanding that he come down to hell with her. Mm-hmm. That like, I am unwilling to give you up. I would prefer, and I like how he put it, I would prefer you to live in misery with me than to enjoy happiness. So that the total deprivation of love at that point, that she's calling love, as this attachment. Now what we're gonna see is this next man who's coming in. And in the beginning, when you see him, you kind of go, you know, here's this mother who we can sympathize with. But and then the next step here is now comes into the scene this man who doesn't even look like the other ghosts, who are kind of whitish, but he's like oily, greasy, and he has this red lizard on his shoulder that's whispering to him. And even, I mean, this is, it's yucky. Like even he's saying things where he's like, shh, stop. And then it keeps whispering to him, and then he starts smiling. So he's clearly enjoying what this lizard is saying to him, right? And so this is this particular character, this man with the lizard, if you guys are ready to go into him for a minute, mm-hmm. You're gonna hear, people are probably, if they haven't heard this story yet, they will hear it in other talks, because people will use this often when talking about the redeeming power of God over the passions, like that, how he can redeem the passions. And I love that the example here is lust, because a lot of times when we talk about lust, people are like, ew, you know, like that people are like, that's like kind of like embarrassing. Whereas we could talk about like this mother love, and it's, you know, beautiful and wonderful, and like we're not really afraid to talk about that. But a lot of times people can be afraid or shy away from talking about lust, you know, and but it is a lower passion, right? So and I absolutely love, and I think it gives so much hope, this story we're going into, for people who have struggled, you know, with either this kind of compulsive thinking, or who have struggled with like pornography, or who have struggled with various sins regarding lust because of what God does, because they can feel so gross and oily, you know, when that's happening, or right after they've realized and been convicted of it. But yeah, so I wanted to get into this guy if we can.
Mm-hmm. Oh, or even something like gossip, or, you know, mm-hmm. detraction, or any of those things that you get a little bit of a, maybe a temporary sort of kick out of, and it's this habit of behavior that kind of like stays with you. I mean, I love that C.S. Lewis just goes so incredibly obviously hard with this character, and like what, like the image of the character, like you've literally got like a little red lizard on your shoulder, like whispering mm-hmm. in your ear. It's almost like, you know, we're not going to miss this analogy here. This one's going to be very, very clear.
Right.
And I, it's so obviously juxtaposed with the one before, like you were saying, Rachel. You know, they had just finished talking about like the highest sort of passion of order being this mother love. And then they almost just are like, Cius is asking the question of, well, surely it doesn't seem like someone who has this higher level of passion should be as likely to be condemned as someone who would have like a lower or baser sort of passion. And it's almost like George McDonald's like, well, let's look over here. So like exhibit B is walking onto the scene with this guy here. But I love how you said that, like, he seems to have this fondness for the thing that's causing him temptation, at the same time, is incredibly like embarrassed about it. Because as the angel, because he's actually, the angel is the person who's with them. Like it seems to be like even off, like maybe higher sort of category of spirit that's greeting them in this instance. He's like, oh, you know, clearly I was a mistake to bring him. I'm just going to like take him back home. and then I'll be back like on the next bus. Like I promise I'll be back on the next bus, which is, you know, so indicative sometimes of habitual or addictive behaviors where you're just like, oh, well, I'm not ready yet to come into the light, but like, I'll be back. Like,
can we do this gradually?
Yeah.
Next week. Like I got this kind of thing.
Yeah. The process. The process. I really enjoyed the process of how they got rid of it and like the whole banter about it and just kind of the idea of like maybe like the excuses, like I'll figure my crap out in a minute, just let me have some time and I'll try and figure it out on my own kind of thing. Which is how a lot of those like lust and a lot of those sins like manifest, where it's like, I think I got it, it's not that big of a deal, like I'm figuring it out. But but ultimately it's like when he says like, do you want me to kill it? I can't kill it unless you like give me permission to kill it. Like, do you want me to kill it? And it kind of took that whole conversation of them kind of going back and forth, where he was kind of like, I know you think I'm a coward, but it isn't that really. It isn't, you know, like he's also giving the banter back to him where he's like, I can just kill it for you, you know? And I think I loved that whole process because it kind of showed almost like in a very, like, it wasn't comical, but it was just kind of a tangible way of how we can kind of rid ourselves of this sin, and how ultimately it's going to take, it's going to be painful. Like there's going to be some sort of pain that comes with the killing of that, where he's like, are you burning me? Like, what is happening? I did think it was interesting that it was detached from him, whereas a lot of the other ghosts, it was all like, like internal. But this one was like a physical detachment of him, whereas like its own entity. And I don't know why it was depicted as such, but maybe because he was like trying to portray it as a lesser of a passion. But anyway, I don't know the answer to that, but I just thought it was interesting that, like with the other characters that we met, a lot of it was like an internal struggle as they were like processing it, but this was like a physical thing on the shoulder.
Yeah, that is really interesting. I hadn't thought about that before.
Yeah, I haven't thought about
that either. But it also I wrote down kind of the opposite of how, what he thinks about it. You know, he thinks that if this dies, I'm gonna die too. And like he sees it as being so fundamentally like a part of who he is, or his identity, that he thinks that getting rid of it will actually kill him. And so, yeah, it's interesting that it's something detached in the depiction, but the person himself feels that it's so intertwined with who he is.
Yeah, where you're right, where he would actually feel like it would kill him, even though it was an detached thing.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I think this character was really interesting seeing it. And of course, the transformation is just beautiful and so powerful. And I was reading this and it was one of the sections where I just had to like, I wasn't crying, I wasn't brought to tears, but it was just so enthralling where I was just kind of like reading it and I'm like, wow, this is like an actual ghost that we're going to see. This was the first time we saw like the ghost who's decided to go. Yeah. I was like, finally, there's one. Yeah. Like I've been waiting this whole book.
I like put the book down and like put my hands up like someone scored a touchdown.
It finally happened. And how glorious it was too. Yes. Like it wasn't like, and then he became solid and he started walking up the mountain. It was like, let's go to the description, shall we? Okay. When he rose, I thought his face shone with tears, but it may have been only the liquid love and brightness. One cannot distinguish them in that country, which flowed from him. I had not long to think about it. In joyous haste, the young man leaped onto the horse's back. Turning in his seat, he waved a farewell, then nudged the stallion with his heels. They were off before I knew well what was happening. And later on, as I watched, I noticed the whole plain and forest were shaking with a sound, which in our world would be too large to hear. But there, I could take it with joy. I knew it was not the solid people who were singing. It was the voice that of that earth, those woods and those waters, a strange, archaic, inorganic noise that came from all directions at once. The nature or arch nature of that land rejoiced to have been once more ridden and therefore consummated in the person of the horse. Isn't that awesome? Mm-hmm. Like the redemption mm-hmm. of that passion.
Mm-hmm. And that when like redeemed or transformed, mm-hmm. it's actually the thing he rides into glory.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Like
yeah.
it was so great. I mean, it was like, you know, the line in scripture of like how the rejoicing in heaven over one repentant sinner. Like it felt like that, a description, a vivid description mm-hmm. with a song, with a lovely mm-hmm. little song, you know, like yeah. of what that looks like.
Yeah.
And you can't help but just like being like, yes, let's go. Like,
yeah.
Like this thing that that he identified with, right? And we can say that to ourselves, the thing that I identify with, like, this is who I am. This is a defect of my personality or whatever. I love it. It says in the second paragraph of that song, it says, place, authority will be given you. The strengths that once opposed your will shall be obedient fire in your blood and heavenly thunder in your voice. Overcome us that so overcome we may be ourselves. It's like so good.
It's so good. It's so good. And it on 114, this is just this other like C.S. Lewis quote that you'll find everywhere. I'm sure, Rachel, this was in your 365 days book. On at the end of kind of the big paragraph in the middle of the page where it says, lust is a poor, weak, whimpering, whispering thing compared to that richness and energy of desire which will arise when lust has been killed. Mm-hmm. When, you know, when we don't settle for like that first thing, you know, that for the instinct, that first thing, but rather like mm-hmm. allow the desire to be transformed, that it can't even compare mm-hmm. to what it's replaced with. And the mm-hmm. and the image of the stallion is just perfect as well. And then it makes this great comparison at the end, which of course, if I could do a Scottish accent, I would, but I cannot, and so I won't. Where George MacDonald says, ye must ask if the risen body, even of appetite, is as grand a horse as ye saw, what would the risen body of maternal love or friendship be?
It made me think of the Blessed Mother. You know, she would be the opposite of this grieving mother, you know, in the beginning. She too is a grieving mother, but it was she willed him toward the Father's plan for her, you know, her son, towards the Father's plan. And at every moment was submitted to him. And that even like she loved her son, who was the most perfect son to ever exist. She loved him in and for the Father. That it wasn't like, I mean, of course she could love and adore her son because, you know, and truly adore him and because of, but you think she could have tried to hold on to him. Mm-hmm. She could have been, you know, in a way, like the voice of the enemy would whisper to Jesus in the desert, just skip out on the suffering, you know, just skip out on this. Like you're God, right? Mm-hmm. So you can skip out on this. Not once did that thought cross the Blessed Mother's mind because she always loved in the Father. And so she becomes the most fruitful and glorious mother of all of them because that love is always at every moment a redeemed and holy love. Mm-hmm. And so we see this amazing like redemption of lust, but the glory of her maternal love that is given.
I think with both of these characters, I started to think about how they're, and throughout this entire book, but how the perception of God that people have. And so you look at the grieving mother, and she said, you know, I believe, we just had talked about this quote, but like, I believe in that, you know, in a God of love. And, you know, if he hadn't taken him away, you know, he would bring me my son. And it was like how she had perceived love and God's love was, it was a false reality of what it actually is. And then you see this guy, and he had this idea of the love of God in a different way, where he was holding on to, you know, a sin or a passion. And he didn't, I don't know, there was almost, I guess it doesn't really go into that much of how he perceived God, but it was enough to say, okay, I guess I want you to kill it. You know, I want you to kill mm-hmm. this thing. There was enough trust yeah. that God could transform something. Like there mm-hmm. was enough of that faith that said, I don't know exactly, you know, who God is, but, or what God's love looks like, but I trust enough to mm-hmm. surrender something, a letting go of self. Mm-hmm. And how it was just the distinction of those, even in these two characters, how they had perceived God and how willing were they to just like, to literally to let go and to surrender to the actual love that God has instead of this perceived love mm-hmm. of who God is, and how it ended up being transformative for him, where he was actually able to experience, you know, he goes up the mountain, he sees the actual eternal love that he had been yeah. longing for. But the whole idea of the perception of God mm-hmm. or the perception of love.
Mm-hmm. You know, he does. He has this profound surrender of the self, because isn't it when the angel asks him, then he said, you know, the man was like, it will kill me. I know it's going to kill me. And he said, mm-hmm. okay, so what if it does? And he says, you're right. I would rather die than live with this thing, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not some kind of, what's the word? Nihilistic thing. He's like, I'm ready for all of it to go mm-hmm. and to surrender myself into what you have, what can happen here. And so all of myself is going to die and surrender and die like the seed in the ground, you know, not knowing what will happen next. He didn't know the redemption that was going to happen next. Mm-hmm. He just knew that he was ready to submit and be healed by the other and a trust by the other, instead of, yeah, like you were saying, Angela, putting his desire instead of, you know, yeah, the contrast of the woman who puts her, who even in words that sound like they could, I guess, make sense. Like, I believe in a God of love. No God would ever, you know, separate a mother and son. And like, there's a part of us that would go, yeah, right, right, right. Mm-hmm. And yet that's her fabrication of who God is. That's not a surrender to the other. It's still herself who's in the center.
Where it's like a fabrication of what love is, maybe too.
Yeah.
Like,
mm-hmm.
like we believe in a God of love. Like that is a fact that God is it, love itself, but that love itself kind of, so much of that involves us having a sort of death to ourselves, mm-hmm. to having a sort of death to the desires and to our wants, and mm-hmm. so that we can live in that love that he has.
Well, that's bigger than us. It feels like in both of these cases, it these people were creating and holding desperately onto what they thought was what they needed for happiness. Mm-hmm. And it required them to hand that thing over and to believe in the fact that the Lord wills for their happiness and will not fail to bring it about. And they just, in the case of the woman, she had an idea of what it had to look like, and she wasn't willing to compromise on what that was going to be, even if it meant taking her son to hell with her. Yeah. And then in the case of the lizard guy, I kept thinking of the scripture passage of, you know, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. And he was willing to say, this thing that I've been using to make me happy, I submit it to you, because I believe that you have something better for me.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's the key right there. Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Sarah Smith.
Ah, oh, Sarah. Sarah. Ah. Man. Yeah. She's one of the great ones.
She's one of the great ones. Yeah. Like, you wouldn't have known her. You wouldn't have known about her there, but fame here is different than fame. on Earth. Yeah. Whew.
Yeah. So this is chapter 12, where we get that the beautiful procession coming with angels frolicking and flowers being thrown and songs being sung. And it's just overwhelmingly joyous. And then I love that the C.S. Lewis character, without going all the way, says, is it, you know, and you know he means, is it the Blessed Mother? Is it her? Yeah. Is she coming?
He's like, nope, not even her. Like, this mm-hmm. is how good it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just kind of like a random, I mean, especially with the last name Smith. It's like,
yeah, the most plain, you know.
Yeah, the most common
No
name.
Offense to the Sarah Smiths of the world, but there's a lot of Sarah Smiths.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But it's like everybody, this isn't just Sarah Smith, that right, there's the other I mean, we're hearing about her story, but like this is kind of how a lot of people would live. Is that what he's saying too?
Wait, say that again.
It's a Sarah Smith. It's a Sarah Smith. It's like there's more of
yeah, like in this yeah, in this book common. Like yeah, like it would this be like a common occurrence here to see. Or is this like an elevation? Do you guys know what I'm asking?
I think I do. Go ahead, like, say a different
in
way.
This story, is Sarah Smith like something that happens often? Is she just how the ghosts, I mean not the ghosts, the spirits are treated? Or is she like actually elevated for
I think she's elevated in the because of you know how he says, like, okay, so she has this procession of like these children who are mm-hmm. processing with her, and then these animals who are processing mm-hmm. with her. And he says, you know, she was like, you know, when you drop a rock into water and then there's the rings that come out from it. It's because it was like all of the, you know, like this parable of the 10 talents, like they came back and it was like this multiplication of the way she loved.
Okay, so she just was here on earth, she just like loved these people and these, it was like how she lived, and then it was reflected of that.
Yeah,
on earth like she was common, but in heaven, like on earth she would be of no note, she would not be famous. She would have looked to have lived a very average life from the outside, but in heaven she's one of the great ones. Like,
oh, yeah,
that's cool.
Sarah Smith from Golders Green, which is one that they have her hood listed here. That's so great. Yeah, I think we have to just read some of the description. I mean, I don't think we can say it any better than on 119, where it describes her and the C.S. Lewis character is processing with George MacDonald, like, what is happening here? This is, and he's like, oh yeah, it's just Sarah Smith. And he's like, this, but she's clearly like a deal, like what's going on with that? And he starts saying, like, who are all these young men and women who are on each side of her? And then George MacDonald said, those are her sons and daughters. And then he says, she must have had a very large family, sir. And then he says, every young man or boy that met her became her son, even if it was only the boy that brought the meat to her back door. Every girl that met her was her daughter. And then he says, isn't that a bit hard on their own parents? And George MacDonald says, no, there are those that steal other people's children, but her motherhood was of a different kind. Those on whom it fell went back to their natural parents, loving them more. Few men looked on her without becoming, in a certain fashion, her lovers, but it was the kind of love that made them not less true, but truer to their own wives.
That is so good.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
that is love. Yeah. Like, but like that is what, like, the just pure Christ-like love living in a human being could do.
You know, and it's a redeemed femininity, because it's specifically, you know, her motherhood and there's the image of mother and the image of bride, right? That no child came to her who did not become her child, and she sent them back to love their own parents more, back to be even more faithful, even more living, even more passionately in the truth and more of who they are meant to be. And the men who came into her life, you know, they, in a sense, I love that, in becoming, in a certain fashion, her lovers, but it was the kind of love that made them not less true, but truer to their own wives, that her femininity was so healing in those two roles of our identity as women. I think that's a really good way to think. Like when people come, you know, when people come to me, am I loving them in this way? You know, when other people's children come to me, am I loving them as my own children? Am I welcoming them? Am I caring for them, you know, deeply and who they are? And then when other, and you know, this is a really good, you know, for me as a married woman, for other married women, or just for any woman in the world, you know, coming across whoever, whatever man and whatever their vocation is in that moment, is this man leaving this encounter with me, desiring to go back into the world, living his vocation even more passionately, mm-hmm. you know, with even more faithfulness. And it's not because of what I did, but because I'm living them in God, right? That it's not, you know, it's not a perversion of love. It's a redeemed love that wants only what is holy, you know, only what is good. And I loved that she's kind of this redeemed picture of an everyday woman who is redeemed in her motherhood and in being a bride. So,
mm-hmm. And I love that too, because it doesn't necessarily talk about like her physical children or anything like that. Like it could be, you know, that she didn't have any, or, you know, because it's almost like this beautiful idea of spiritual motherhood mm-hmm. that we have as women, where we are able to fully live out, like you were saying, Rachel, just like fully live out our feminine genius in this way that illuminates holiness, to whatever person we're interacting with, whether that be, you know, children or other people's spouses, that they can actually be, they can leave a conversation with us. And this is ultimately like the goal, right? Is that there's that great Edith Stein quote. I'm going to find it and I'm going to say it, but that ultimately, like as women, like we are called to be that place where other souls can grow. And
yes, I know which one you're talking about. I'll get
it. Hold on. So good.
Well, and she's such a contrast of like her story is such a contrast to the other ones that we had just had of a vocation in motherhood or in as a wife, like in the way that this one is so surrendered to God, and what the graces that flow from the love of a woman that has been completely immersed in the love of Christ. Mm. It's so incredibly powerful. And I think the description of Sarah Smith, although it is a description of a wife, I think it is mostly a description of what God wishes to do through the feminine genius, mm-hmm. like and how when it is fully just submitted to his movement, like the power of that.
Yeah.
This is the Edith Stein quote. It says, "The woman's soul is fashioned as a shelter in which other souls may unfold."
That's really good.
That's really good.
And then you look at her husband as we meet Frank.
Frank. Yeah. You know, and she didn't, obviously we know from this encounter with Frank, she did not have an easy life. Mm-hmm. So she had a very difficult husband. She had a very difficult husband who did not go to heaven. And he was manipulative. I mean, he has like gaslighting tendencies, right? He's straight up gaslighting her in heaven, attempting to
mansplaining. He's mansplaining her in heaven after she walks by in this procession.
Yeah, and he's like, "How could you dare tell me about love?" And you know, and he's a caricature of himself. Like she refuses to talk to the fake image that he's projecting and attempting to communicate to her through, and she's looking at him and the love that comes out of her, the humility, apologizing to him for the way she imperfectly loved him throughout their lives, but yet her honesty, like, you know, you used pity against people trying to manipulate us so that we would feel bad about our joy. You wanted us to come to you, but we can't do that here. You have to come out of the shell. You've got to come out of your tragedy. Your, oh my gosh, what's that thing? Tragedian. You can't play that here. I'm not looking at it. I'm not talking to it. And then finally, when the little gnome, not gnome, what is he? Little dwarf.
He's a gnome now. Now
I
he's
pictured
a gnome.
Him as a gnome.
He had a hat. It wasn't You're listed, like, but I'm quite certain.
As the elf. Little dwarf man disappeared, she looks at that fake, the fake tragedian.
Tragedian.
Tragedian. And is like, who are you? Stop it. Like, you're a liar. This is not who you are. Mm-hmm. I don't know who you are. You can either depart from me, but you need to give this man back. I mean, she has this authentic love for him. She desires a man who made her life very difficult to be in heaven and to convert, finally, in this last minute, to convert. And he just can't stand it. But what was y'all's take? I want to hear this because I have thoughts about this. What was your take on her reaction once he finally does make his choice and disappears? On page 133, there was no answer. The bottom 133, there was no answer. I'm sorry. I cannot love a lie, said the lady. I cannot love the thing which is not. I am in love, and out of it I will not go. There was no answer. The tragedian had vanished. The lady was alone in that woodland place, and a brown bird went hopping past her, bending with its light feet the grass as I could not bend. Presently, the lady got up and began to walk away. The other bright spirits came forward to receive her, singing as they came. And then going on and on in that beautiful song about her and kind of just like, in a way, like conquering all, like God is her defender. And Jesus is like, what, doesn't she feel a little bad? And he's like, no. Because his pity has no power anymore. His self-pity and his attempt to control her by making her feel bad for him does not work here. And so she's not, no, she doesn't feel bad for him. She didn't want that for him, but it was like his final attempt was that she would feel bad for him and she would be miserable for him. And he was like, no, because that's not of God. Mm-hmm. Feeling bad for someone because they want you to feel bad for them so that your joy is tampered is not from God. I think it's pretty bold. I really like that. And I think it's really healthy psychologically too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it's kind of this at the end, pity will not be able to like to blackmail people anymore. It will, the line that I just jotted in my notebook was, our light can swallow up your darkness, but your darkness cannot now infect our light. Mm-hmm. And so C.S. Lewis seems to have a little bit of an issue with it at first. Like you kind of said, like, don't you feel bad? Shouldn't these people be troubled by the loss of one soul? How could you enjoy heaven if you knew that others were not? And George MacDonald goes into a very good explanation of how that basically, I'm trying to find it. Where is it? Yeah.
Sun, it must be one way or the other. Either the day must come when joy prevails and all the makers of misery are no longer able to infect it, or else forever and ever the makers of misery can destroy in others the happiness they reject for themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's and like this the contrast of it.
And hell should not be able to veto heaven. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because if it were the case that the saints could not enjoy joy.
Right.
Because of those who had chosen willfully against it, then they would have the power, in fact, to limit joy and love. And
like it's impossible for it to be here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It can't, it has no power.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And also because in George MacDonald says like everybody had the choice. So it's, he made a choice. So that was the choice, but his choice has no power over her. Mm-hmm. And so it wasn't like, oh gosh, look at this bad draw that he got. It was like, no, he chose this reaction. And he chose this. Mm-hmm. And
and then was it in this it was this conversation when he was saying, why didn't she go back to hell with him, or go and be with him? Or and then he goes into the description of kind of just the vastness of heaven compared to hell, and he was like, she couldn't fit into hell.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, I love that whole, how he describes how he describes like heaven versus hell and how huge and how eternal and how real and how it's like so in comparison so tiny. It's like that can't, that like literally doesn't work, like she can't even fit there.
He uses a grass, a piece of grass as a pointer. Yes. You know, I thought that was such a whimsical but also profound image of like kind of like picking up a piece of grass and then trying to like get down low enough to show the crack in the ground. And I'm not sure if it was this one that you came up from, but it was one no bigger than this one that you did. I remember the first time that I read this book just being like, everything started to unfold in such a way where you started to look back over the whole book and get it so much more. And I remember that line and that visual of just showing the difference between the vastness of heaven and the substance of heaven and how full it is and how deep you can go to, like they said that all of hell would not be an atom of heaven.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, like if a butterfly were to swallow.
Yeah, well, it's like Saint Catherine of Siena. This isn't like a, this is also very Catholic because Saint Catherine of Siena talks about, you know, sin renders you into nothingness. Mm. So it's not, and then, you know, virtue begins to make, it makes you solider and solider. And so, yeah, I think that that's a really good image of that just like, you know, kind of going nothing, 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 nothing of final traces. So. Mm-hmm. That's good. All right. Final takeaways.
Well, can we do, does anybody else get the spoiler of the bus driver?
Wait, what happens with the bus driver?
Oh,
okay. Wait, did I miss something?
I think I'm right. Okay. Can I
Hold
cut
on.
This later if this doesn't make any sense. So look at 139.
Okay.
So they're talking about, could she have made herself small enough to go down there? Right. And they're like, no, even though she's a good one, she couldn't have done that. And it says, only the greatest, capital G, can of all can make himself small enough to enter hell. For the higher a thing is, the lower it can descend. Only one has descended into hell. And this C.S. Lewis's character is like, but he did that a long time ago. And then George MacDonald says, all moments that have been or shall be, were or are present in the moment of his descending. There is no spirit in prison to whom he did not speak.
Oh,
I just and got so chills.
If you go back to the beginning where they talk about what the bus driver looked like.
Oh my gosh, wait, you're going to blow my mind.
I'm going to just hold on. I got to find it. Hold on. Okay, it's on 3. And you notice at the very bottom of 3, it says, the driver, capital D, himself seemed full of light, and he used only one hand to drive with. The other he waved before his face as if to fan away the greasy steams of the rain. A growl went up from the queue as he came in sight. Looks as if he's had a good time of it, huh? Bloody pleased with himself, I bet. My dear, why can't he behave naturally? Thinks himself too good to look at us. Who does he imagine he is? All that gilding and purple. I call it a wicked waste. I could see nothing in the countenance of the driver to justify all this, unless it were that he had a look of authority that and seemed intent on carrying out his job.
My gosh.
What?
Oh my gosh.
Yes! Wow.
That's
epic.
That's so good.
Right?
Oh, Jesus.
Yes.
That is so great. I love it.
Oh, and that it and that this, it's so beautiful, right? It's so beautiful, the mercy of God that extends to every single one who chooses it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And that the greatest of all rendered himself the smallest of all for the sake of his sons and daughters, that might present to them the choice to choose joy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the tears. They said it. This got me.
Oh, yes. Oh no, you start. If you start up the things, no.
It's so good. Oh my gosh, I love that. How beautiful.
Thank you, C.S. Lewis, for giving us
what a gem. A gem of a book.
Man.
I'm so glad that we read it, guys. What a great Core Christi book.
Hey, it's come full circle.
has.
We've gotten a walk with Angela.
Guys, what the heck
is
this?
And Angela, almost quit.
You're ending in tears, Angela. Crying. Let's just for perspective.
Yeah, I'm ending in tears. This is how I end my journey.
All right. Well, with that, man, that's so good. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can. I don't even know what to say.
No,
I'm still.
Talk
my mind
that.
Is still blown.
I love that. I know.
I completely missed that.
I didn't. I don't think I got it till the second time or third time. Or I don't know how many times it took me.
Awesome.
It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful, and that's like this book is so beautiful. For just like the two things. Okay, two things. One is showing us our own attachments and calling us to step in the right direction toward deeper heaven, right? And then two, showing us the heart of the box. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's just so beautiful. For that. And four.
So good. Yeah, it's really good. Mm-hmm. All right, guys. Any Alrighty. Other thoughts? We're good to go? It's so a good, good stopping point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lovely.
All right. Thanks so much for joining this discussion. We had a great time going through this study and all of the studies that we've had for Core Christi. We wanted to let you know that we're entering a new season for our Core Christi small groups to focus on Lectio Divina. So because of that, we won't be having our monthly podcast for the time being. Please feel free to go back to any of our studies and join in them either yourself or with your small groups. We've put all of the discussion questions into the links for each of the episodes, so feel free to use them however you would like. We're so grateful for all the Lord has done so far, and we're really looking forward to His Holy Spirit's movement in our time of Lectio Divina together. Stay tuned with our newsletter for everything that's happening with Core Christi over 2023, and we pray that you have a very blessed Advent as we head into this new season.